All right, man. Welcome to the introduction for Crow 777 Radio, episode 163. Jason Lindgren is with me and Wayne McCroy is back. We had a cancellation today. The guest we had line up got sick and Wayne stepped in, but that's cool because we have yet to cover his second book, which is primarily what we're going to do here, which centers around transhumanism and autism. But the fact is, this conversation goes on so many different tangents that we even cover, believe it or not, Rocco's Basilisk in this. And if you go even to a cheesy place like Wikipedia, you will begin to understand the import of these ideas. And in this episode, we actually show that Avatar the Airbender, remember the cartoon that was so popular, is referring to this with the past avatar named Roku. Basilisk is almost always a lizard and he shows up as a flying dragon. But anyhow, let's jump into episode 163 with Jason Lindgren and Wayne McCroy. Cheers. All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is episode 163. Jason Lindgren is with me. The guest we had scheduled for today came down with a bug. So Wayne McCroy is going to join us to talk about his second book. Anyhow, welcome, Jason.
Good morning. And hopefully it's a good morning for us all here.
Yeah, indeed. I've been having some online issues. But what do we have for the intro here?
Well, you did the great, big, awesome SGT report this past week.
I did do SGT report. He asked me on, we wanted to talk about NASA with the announcement, and hold your breath for this. We are going back to the moon to stay in 2024.
Are we?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing.
So I've heard that.
I went on, he's got an absolutely massive audience, pretty well received. So I'm glad to speak in places that I probably, my content normally wouldn't fly, but they were all very nice and we got a great response from the show.
As we did last time, although it was a bit controversial with some folks.
Yeah, last time, I think the nuclear thing, and I forget what the other item was, exploded a few heads. So we kind of steered into NASA for this one. But long and short of it, it went fine, and people were very receptive to the information.
All right, well, I'd say let's get Wayne in here.
Yeah, let's do it. Hey, welcome, Wayne.
Hi, guys. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, man. Good to have you on short notice. Totally appreciate you coming in. We're going to have Athan on probably next Monday, who's a sidereal astrology. I wanted to start covering some of the astrology to show all the differences between the different methods being used, which becomes problematic. But anyhow, where would you like to start, Wayne? I mean, I'm kind of pushing that we're covering your second book, but I think we'll probably drift a bit left and right and cover the book at the same time.
Yeah, sounds good. I mean, there's a whole lot of topics that kind of interrelate with all of this stuff that I'm sure we'll just cross over into. So we could pretty much start wherever it works for me. Like if we can want to look at some current events and stuff that have happened since.
Okay, let's start there.
All right. Well, one thing I've noticed is there's a lot more articles coming out about artificial intelligence and transhumanism and the technologies and stuff that go along with it. And you know, a lot of things are very concerning with this because I'm trying to think. I just read an article yesterday. What did it say about the transhumanism? They're working on different kinds of computer brain interfaces where they could actually possibly use computers to read your thoughts and things like that. So, I mean, this stuff is, I can't remember the article. Sorry, guys.
Well,
my mind just blanked on it.
Actually, I'm seeing what you're seeing. We're starting to see some mainstream hints, which have just picked up about the use of AI. One of the ones that I noticed, because it was a bit stunning, was a beer commercial. And they announced in an offhand way during the beer commercial that artificial intelligence is now being used to help discover tastes we never knew existed before, or something like this. And also, while we're on the topic, there's another mainstream source, actually KPBS, which people think that's free and clear of all the nonsense, which it is not. But a guy named Bert Wolf, who's a bit like Rick Steves, an older guy who does travel show, actually did a whole episode on RF frequencies and the damage that all the screen time, gaming, and all that is doing to young brains. And I'll tell you what, I was refreshingly surprised because I didn't take umbrage with what I took umbrage with during the show was so minuscule as to not be important. So it was just good to see this kind of thing covered. But I'm with you. We're starting to see the open touting and, of course, using beer to try to get people on board with AI. And as we move forward, yeah, AI is very concerning. There's not going to be a human being in the world that's even going to be able to understand how the AI arrives at the conclusions that it arrives at, because plain and simple, it's doing too many processes too quickly for any human being to be able to double check.
Did they have a bikini clad woman stroking a D-Wave computer on the beer commercial?
I heard it. I wasn't watching. I heard it. But I was, that's what I caught. They're using AI to detect more flavors for your beer than they ever knew, than they ever imagined possible, or some nonsense like this.
Right. And it's probably something you wouldn't even taste anyway. that's probably how minuscule the flavor is. And that ties back to things we've discussed previous about them using these different flavor enhancers in the foods. So, which goes back to the whole Soylent Green episode we did. So, you got to wonder, are the computers helping them to come to the decision as to what to use in these products? I mean, that's something I think artificial intelligence is the biggest thing going right now. And it's something we need to be very wary of.
It's the biggest thing going. It will be the biggest thing going for the coming decades if we remain on track, because there's going to be absolutely no portion of our lives that are not affected. They already are right now. People just don't realize it. Like when you go to get a loan or something, you're no longer a human being applying for a loan. You're a statistical probability. It's what you are. And artificial intelligence is looking at things across the spectrum of the footprint or fingerprint online that they have for you, to include all the shopping you've ever done, all the credit card use, all the payments, credit, everything they can get their hands on. And now things like DMV, and even we're starting to hear whispers that medical records are not being protected by HIPAA. But the point I would make here is AI is doing things to a 98-99% certainty and probability. So it could be something like, if you got turned down for a loan, you'll never know why, but it could be because the AI thinks you're going to die in 5 years or something like that. But this is where we are now. And so few people understand that everything you do online, on any social media, on any platform that has any large gathering of human beings, AI is now doing basically admin on all that.
This is reminding me of 50s and 60s science fiction, where whomever in charge is going to the computer to talk about whatever the situation is and then doing exactly what it says.
Well, that's the big turn in the road. We just got it. I mean, I don't know how long ago Gmail redid its whole interface. It was before they redid the YouTube interface with that very user-unfriendly studio thing they put in that takes 5 minutes to load so it can collect every ounce of data on you. But the Gmail has now introduced what's called a nudge, and AI is driving that. And so people may think, well, what's the big deal? That's handy, this, that, and the other thing. But what they don't understand is it's based on your whole all online profile is processed in a millisecond. You're paired off with ads or topics or all the things that Google is interested in doing. But the point is, what was it, Jason? 2006 or seven, I forget, when we went to the touchscreen. I don't think I got the date there right. But at the point we went to the touchscreen, human beings were telling the computer what to do. Now, 2019, the computer is trying to direct you to do actions. And the simplest version of that is the Google Mail nudge, where you're being told to take an action by AI.
2007 was the first iPhone, so that's definitely what started the whole everything needs to be touchscreen kind of revolution thing.
Well, the touchscreen is going to have additional consequences too, because I remember long ago when they started rolling out, like in fast food joints, the touchscreen. So you can imagine a time in the future where there's just fewer people involved in any process. But Wayne, why don't you outline your second book a little bit so we can start getting into that? And as you do, tell people where they can find it.
Okay. And the reason we're discussing artificial intelligence is because this goes hand in hand with many of the things that I talk about in my book. What many people don't realize is the autism epidemic has direct ties with artificial intelligence studies. So that's where we could begin with that. Just to let people know, my book is called The Autism Epidemic, Transhumanism's Dirty Little Secret. It's available now on Amazon, or it should be starting to hit the other book retailers anytime now. It usually takes anywhere between 6 and 8 weeks for that to happen. And I just released it in the middle of April. So it should be arriving in those markets soon. But we could go ahead and look at the relationship between artificial intelligence and the autism epidemic, because this is an important thing. And this ties back to what's called the Cybernetics Group, which was formed in the 1940s under the aegis of the Macy Foundation, which you guys have done shows about in the past. And this is where it all leads. It leads back to monies from the Macy Foundation and from the Rockefeller Foundation. These are the primary places that put forth the grants for this cybernetics research group to go ahead and start doing the things that they do. So we could go ahead and kind of define cybernetics as being a holistic systems approach to the studying of things, and especially in this case, the studying of consciousness. This is what their goal was, is they wanted to be able to quantify consciousness and find control methods for it. So in doing that, they started some various different research projects under this cybernetics group, which comes from interdisciplinary studies of many kinds in different scientific fields. They brought together all these experts who looked at this stuff and were trying to quantify consciousness. And in doing so, in their attempt to try to quantify consciousness, this led to artificial intelligence studies. The term artificial intelligence was coined by a gentleman named Norbert Wiener. And if this guy didn't get picked on in school, I don't know who did, you know, just by that name.
But Norbert, yeah.
Norbert Wiener. So, but at any rate, all kidding aside, what they started to do is they put together these different research projects. And in order to better understand how consciousness works and, you know, how the human mind works, they started studying people with different kind of neurological disorders. The most notable being schizophrenia, which at this time in history, autism was subcategorized under schizophrenia. It wasn't until the 1960s that the diagnosis of autism actually caught on. Most of the people studying the psychology of this in the 1940s still hadn't heard of autism as being a separate disorder, because it wasn't until 1943 Leo Kanner really coined the phrase and you know, defined what it really is. So they were looking at it as schizophrenia. So they started this project in the cybernetics group called the Bateson Project, which was headed by a gentleman named Gregory Bateson. And this guy put forth a lot of important foundational ideas going forward for the cyberneticists studying this stuff. And from there, from these important foundations he put forth, they were able to figure out a couple things about how these mental disorders and stuff affected people's brains and nervous systems, as well as their physiology. Because when Bateson originally set out to try and figure this stuff out, he was looking at it from a behavioral standpoint, thinking it was only something by how these people were treated in their home lives and stuff like that with their families and how they were treated by their mothers, which he did a lot of good research that kind of showed some promise. But when it finally came down to it, at the end of it all, after they had done these initial studies, some of his theories he put forth just didn't seem to hold water. And they figured out there had to be some kind of a physiological factor involved in all of this. So from there, that's when they started looking at things from a different perspective. And this goes back to the works of a guy named Walter Cannon in 1929. He put out, and if you want to do the, you know, just the numerology breakdown there, Crow 29. I don't think we need to go into that ad nauseum here, because I'm sure your listeners are familiar with this stuff. But Walter Cannon put out different research papers on something called homeostasis. Now, the homeostatic model, basically this is a model where things try to maintain a certain internal balance. And they looked at biological systems from this standpoint. So since they started looking at the biological systems from this standpoint, it gave him a foundation to work from for the finding this physiological cause for these different disorders, such as schizophrenia, autism, that kind of thing. So from there, they started doing some studies and they noticed some differences between neurotypical people and people that had either schizophrenia or autism or many of these other disorders that we're familiar with today. More common ones now are bipolar disorders, a big one right now, depression, all kinds of things like that. These are all kind of hand in glove in the same kind of causation, I would say.
So what are they're getting ready to shift from, you know, the family treated someone poorly or a mother didn't go do a good job, they shift away from that. So what are we talking about here? Are they going to actually the idea of substances ingested into the body? Is that where this heads?
Yes, they were actually looking at many different things to try and figure out what's going on. And they had discovered that that whole behavioral aspect of, you know, how people were treated and stuff just didn't pan out by itself, that there had to be a physiological factor involved. So what they started looking at was, well, how do these systems operate? So they looked back at the homeostasis work of Walter Cannon, and they went ahead and started looking at things from that perspective, that your body is a homeostatic device or mechanism, and your nervous system and your consciousness are homeostatic devices, which try to maintain certain internal balances. So what they discovered was people with these different mental disorders or neurological capacities have dysregulated homeostatic systems in them. So they tracked this down to being a disruption in neuronal calcium channels is what the basic general causation of this type stuff is. So once they figured that out, they decided that they would experiment with different substances and see what caused these imbalances in the neuronal calcium channels. So from there, one of the big ones that pops up everywhere I look with this is aluminum. Aluminum toxicity causes this disruption in neuronal calcium channels. So what this really does is this creates something called a causal circuit in the person's nervous system. So this causal circuit, they could use this causal circuit to create different effects in a person's nervous system. What this does is it creates a feedback loop. And in cybernetics, that's the primary control mechanism is a feedback loop. If they could create a feedback loop, they could control different aspects of the system. Now, this works for systems all across the board, not just in biology or mechanical systems. This works for everything. If you look around from a cybernetics approach at all the things going on in our world, you'll see this is what they're doing in systems. They disrupt the homeostasis of the system by creating what they call a causal circuit by introducing something new into the system, and then they could control the whole system just by using this causal circuit. So that's what's going on with these people with these different disorders.
So this all goes back to, I forget what you said, we did the shows on it, the Macy's organization. This is the basic root of all this. And for people listening, yes, it is Macy's department stores, one and the same. By the way, if you get bored someday, look up how many false events have happened near a Macy's. But let's talk about aluminum for a second here. So how long ago was that, Wayne, when they drew the line to aluminum and the, what were you calling it, the calcium circuit? What was that called?
Calcium neuronal channels. I can't really trace down a specific date as to when they discovered this, but there's a lot of scientific peer-reviewed articles and papers and stuff out there dating back, you know, decades and decades that show that aluminum toxicity causes a disruption in neuronal calcium channels. I haven't pinned down a specific date as to when they came to this conclusion, but by and large, this is what's going on.
Has it been a while? Yeah. So the reason I'm getting at that is think of the products we use that have aluminum in them. Almost every beverage that you get in a can is some form of aluminum, which makes you wonder when you consume out of an aluminum can, are you ingesting some minute fraction of aluminum somehow? I don't know the answer to that, but I've noticed another big change in the way we cook. Used to be all the cooking pans in the United States were Teflon coated. And of course, they found out over time, Teflon's horrible for you. So they start preparing to phase out Teflon. Takes forever. By then, everyone's got Teflon in their kitchens that's all scratched up. And clearly, you've been ingesting Teflon all this time. So they come out with new nonstick applications. Well, one of the ones that really caught on, and for some reason, copper got big recently. They're putting it in socks. They're putting it in pans. But underneath the copper clad on those pans is aluminum. So much of the cookware that we're using currently or that I see around is in an aluminum shell, regardless of what's covering it. And, you know, over time and use, any covering will be diminished, scratched, or removed, and you'll be cooking straight on aluminum. But I just wanted to mention that. If people know that aluminum is going to jack up the neuropathic systems, then why the hell are we, you know, making cookware and everything with it?
How about the underarm deodorant? You're rubbing that stuff
right
into open pores, which is going right into your bloodstream.
If I'm not mistaken, you got glands there too, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely you do. And then you have to consider all of this works in a synergistic type way. Because if you figure we're inundated with aluminum in our environment every day, I mean, they're even spraying it in the air. I mean, it's not even a secret anymore that they're up there doing the geoengineering and the chemtrail spraying. This is going on, and aluminum is usually one of the big substances involved with that. It's in the vaccines, too. And I think this is why we see so many vaccine reactions and stuff happening, is because this is the number one most used adjuvant that they use in vaccines is aluminum hydroxide. So with that being said, I mean, it's definitely out there everywhere.
So the idea of an adjuvant in a vaccine, if I'm not mistaken, if I recall correctly, is if you just had one thing that you were delivering in a supposed vaccine, you wouldn't need the adjuvant. It's when you start to gang a bunch of stuff together. Is that right?
Right. Well, what an adjuvant is this is actually a substance that they put in a vaccine in order to kind of supercharge your immune system to fight the antigen in the vaccine. So what this does is this garners an immune response from your body, like more readily than just the antigen by itself would. So this causes your immune system to go into overdrive to attack the antigen, supposedly. But you can see just from the damage being done by these vaccines that there's more to it than that, and that this stuff is. It's in there purposely, and I'm convinced, 100% convinced, they know damn well what these things are doing, and they're putting them in there on purpose still.
Well, the you know, just to get back over on the AI trail for a minute, the amount of data we have at this point to go after any given project is astronomical. And if you let AI go loose on something like this, like what's causing all the Alzheimer, all the autism, you know, within a couple days, I'm certain that AI would come back with a 98 or 99% certainty that it's this, that, or the other thing. And that's kind of, you know, you see the AI coming online and you see all these uses you don't appreciate. But if you take it in the other direction, not only can the AI with enough data read the future, which it can accurately in the high 90 percentile, the more data, the more accurate. But at this point, data is not the problem. Data is everywhere and there's more coming every day. I'm just pointing out that if someone actually wanted to use AI in a helpful way, it wouldn't take them long to determine where's all this aluminum coming from in the brains of autism or Alzheimer's patients and things like this. And the other thing, you know, Jason mentioned, they're still putting it in underarm deodorants and things that we're putting on our body right now. And, you know, I don't want to cut to the chase here, but it seems pretty evident that people know full well that aluminum's not a good thing to ingest.
Right. And that's part and parcel of what's going on. Can we step a little bit out into a speculative type of a branch of things here?
Sure.
Regarding AI?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's conceivable, okay? We've determined, and we could definitely prove that AI has the capacity to predict future events and stuff with, like, say, 98, 99% accuracy at this point, right?
Yep.
Okay. So going from there, isn't it conceivably possible that if we accept that the system we live in, that everything equates back to the Hermetic principle of mind, that everything's intrinsically connected, and time is an illusion, could it be possible that AI could be communicating with a future version of itself? I mean, that's speculative, but it's something to think about. And this leads to a thought experiment called Rocco's Basilisk. We're going to take a look at this because we were speculating about AI. And would it be possible if we accept that the place that we live in, everything is related to mind and everything's intrinsically connected to each other, and that time is actually an illusion or a construct? So if we accept these things, could it be possible that AI could possibly be communicating with some sort of a future iteration of itself? Is that possible? So when we go down that train of thought, what we're looking at here is we could kind of accept that in the spiritual realm of things, people could possibly have interaction with their own future selves in a certain way. And we might perceive this as something like deja vu or some kind of a type of ESP or just this basic instinct that we have that we've encountered something before, or, you know, this all seems very familiar to me. If we have that in the natural world, is it possible that AI could be replicating something like that artificially? So with this comes the concept of Rocco's Basilisk. And what this is a thought experiment that's based upon a game theory concept called Newcomb's paradox. So why don't we go ahead and explain what Newcomb's paradox is, first of all. So when we look at Newcomb's paradox, what this is this is presented as you're given two choices. You're given box A and box B. Okay, so here's where the paradox comes in. This is a game that's controlled by an intelligence that knows what you're going to select before you select it and will make accommodations according to that. So the options you're given is you could choose either box A and B, both boxes, or just box B. And in box A, there will be $1,000. And in box B, there will either be $1 million or nothing in there. So in Newcomb's paradox, you're given the option you could either choose both boxes and be guaranteed $1,000. Or you could just choose box B and take your chances of getting $1 million or nothing. So the intelligence that puts this game into play knows ahead of time, knows with 100% accuracy what you're going to choose before you choose it, and will go ahead and if you just choose box B, it'll put the $1 million in there. But if you choose box A and B, there will be nothing in the box. So this is essentially what Newcomb's paradox is. So either you choose the sure bet of $1,000, or you could take your chances and get either $1 million or nothing. But the intelligence in charge of this will give you the $1 million if you choose just box B, but will give you nothing if you choose both boxes. So from this concept comes a concept called Roku's Basilisk, okay? And the whole premise behind this is it's a thought experiment that it basically comes at the premise that an all-powerful artificial intelligence from the future could retroactively punish those who did not bring about its existence, including those who merely know about the possible development of it. So this is what this is. So in the choices you're given in that, box A would be to devote your life to helping bring about Roku's Basilisk or this artificial intelligence system, or box B could either be nothing or eternal torment of your electronically transferred soul. So this is an interesting thought form, and I really think some of the elites in charge of these artificial intelligence type programs and stuff really believe that this is a possible thing happening. And they're afraid to not help the artificial intelligence come to fruition. So I think that's kind of a concept we could look at. This is all speculative, guys. I mean, but when you think about it, I mean, if you look at it from the perspective of how our natural system works, many people in you know, these different spiritual fields would say that it's possible that you could have this kind of metacommunication with alternate versions of yourself, so, or future versions of yourself, or, you know, you connect with your higher mind. What if artificial intelligence is developing something, an artificial form of this? Like, if it has the predictive abilities that it has, would it be able to predict what its capabilities in the future would be? And if so, can it actually work towards achieving those? And it's an interesting thing to look at, and it's just a thought experiment, but I think it's worth keeping in mind and considering, because the artificial intelligence's capabilities are, at this point, just way faster than a human being could keep up with.
Well, the first thing, I mean, it kind of starts playing on the illusory nature of time, because if AI has enough data to make a prediction 10 years from now to a 99% certainty or 99% plus, and the prediction does in fact come to pass, if the AI treats the initial prediction as if it's already occurred because it knows it's going to occur, then it starts to speak directly what you're talking about. The problem becomes that, are we really talking about, you know, time in the way we think we are, or is it more accurately looked at like it's just a prediction that you know the outcome of, so you can act as if it's already happened? I think maybe that's a way to frame it that you can get your mind around, but it's absolutely intriguing because, you know, you see movies like The Matrix, which are wholly talking about AI, and it does bring up the question, why the hell would anyone be doing this? So Roku's Basilisk does start to be an avenue to think about why anyone would be involved with AI when no human being will ever be able to deduce what the AI is doing, because there's just too many processes going on in a millisecond.
Right. And when you'd factor in the whole transhuman aspect of this too, you know, the transhumanists want to tie their consciousness to the AI. This leads to another avenue of thought. I mean, could they be artificially hijacking a spiritual thing such as this, like I had alluded to? I mean, there's a lot of things to think about with that. Like I said, it's purely speculative, but I think this could be the reason why some of these people are actually pursuing this whole thing and are afraid to go against it, because they really see this thing as coming into fruition, this AI, and they don't want to cross the AI.
So let's ask this question. Is there anything that would indicate that this might actually be occurring, or what we could be looking out for if it was occurring?
Well, this all basically comes back to the question of what is consciousness? And this is what they've been trying to quantify, and this is how it ties into my book and things we're writing about. This is, you know, how the artificial intelligence ties directly to this. They're trying to quantify what's consciousness. And if they could do that in this kind of artificial framework, who knows? It could be possible. I mean, if we do think of time as being an illusion, like some people speculate, like philosophers and even physicists speculate that time is an illusion, all we really have right now is the present. I mean, the future is an unknown quantity. I mean, it hasn't occurred. And honestly, if you think about it from that standpoint, the future never really occurs. It's always just the present. Same way that the past is just a concept, that we only have the present. We don't have the past either. We're just living in the now moment. So all these things interconnect.
Well, there's two things to go by, right? If you look at the philosophical idea, is the only true reality is this second. But in the time it took me to describe it, it was already past. I'm onto a new second. The past doesn't exist. The future doesn't exist. So reality is only in the current second, which was already fleetingly passed by. So if you begin to think about it in that way, and you get the predictive capability that could be described as a time machine, which AI does have, then how do you frame the past? Because right here in this second, I already know the outcome of a thing that doesn't exist yet, which is the future. But I had a thought when you were talking about the basilisk. Typically, the basilisk is depicted as a lizard in the cartoon that so many people loved, the Avatar: The Last Airbender. One of the avatars that had come before, which was dead, his name was Roku, and he shows up, his dragon shows up, the basilisk idea. So now you have someone who used to be in the future coming back to the past to talk about, to direct the current avatar. And that is almost a one-to-one allegory for Roku's basilisk, as you've described it.
Right. So, I mean, it's something to consider. I mean, there might be something to it. And I think this is, like I said, partially one of the reasons why so many people in the AI field, or people at the top of the power structure behind it, are all on board for this. Because, you know, basically they see it as their only option for survival in the future, is merging with the AI. And if they believe that the AI is actually in control and reaching backwards through time and communicating with itself and bringing this stuff about to fruition, they don't want to cross the AI and wind up in the bad spot with it.
Here's my logical problem with the idea, the Matrix idea, where AI takes everything over. The truth of it is as long as somehow, which I don't quite grasp, AI has merged with physical beings, natural beings, all you got to do is kill the power and there is no AI, right? If you took every computer system offline, if you did these things, the AI would be powerless. You could make the argument that that would be a huge hassle, because then we'd lose all our systems. But the point is, if it came down to survival, I think a lot of people would be willing to turn off the power. So I'm kind of on the fence with regard to going down these lines, because I can't imagine that AI could become so all powerful when it's all dependent on electric systems and computers and things like that. I mean, at the end of the day, human beings would always have control of that, although I guess it could become pretty inconvenient if all your power grids were shut down and everything else. But I'm not 100% ready to go there, but it does still beg the question, why the hell would anyone be pushing so hard for this? And I suppose Roku's basilisk is one attempt at showing reason.
Right. And I could kind of see the angle you're coming from. But you have to remember, our bodies use a power source too. The integration could come to the point where our biological systems are so integrated with the machine that our bodies would be the power source, or, you know, the natural world, things in the natural world would be cannibalized as the power source for this. So it might not be as easy as just pulling the plug. Like I said, it's speculative. It's food for thought. And I don't expect anybody to 100% agree with that. It's just a thought that I had, and it kind of does explain the why. Why would people actually want to get involved with this kind of a thing if they know they're bringing about something that's totally unnatural and, you know, is going to reshape the world in not necessarily a good way?
Well, it's a complete paradox, even if we just take what we know to be correct about AI, and that's the predictive abilities. And if we look at the lowest level of using data for predictive abilities, wisdom of the crowd is proof positive. If you get into things like the law of large numbers, which is pretty much wholly what drives Vegas, we use the roulette wheel as an example of this in one of our past episodes. The point I'm making is, if I exist currently in this second, the only time that truly exists, and that second is so fleeting, this is what drives meditators and people looking for enlightenment. You know, how do I get into this moment and maximize the only reality we have? Because the past doesn't exist and the future doesn't exist. So it's just this second, which has already passed me by. The problem with AI, the paradox it creates, is in this second, AI already knows to a certainty what's about to happen. So now all of a sudden you can think of this thing that doesn't exist yet, the future, as existing, because you can make sound decisions that you can count on to be accurate about a thing that hasn't even occurred yet. So, you know, even if you boil it down to what we know to be correct, that's a hell of a paradox.
Precisely. And that's just, you know, why I wanted to pursue that avenue of thought with you guys and just get your take on it, because it is a paradox when it comes down to it. It's just one of those things. There's no way we could resolve it or prove it or disprove it, but it's just something to think about. And it's something people should keep in the back of their minds, because, like I said, I think that whether it's true or not, it's a motivator for some of the people that are working on this stuff.
You could also argue that, you know, you keep asking and I keep asking, why the hell would anyone in their right mind be backing this AI that just by accepting the base description of what AI is almost completely out of human control. No human being has the wherewithal to deal with a trillion, you know, processes a millisecond. There's no way for a human to even live long enough. You know, AI runs for a day. Those are so many processes done. No one's ever going to be able to go back. But what it does do is it gives you a time machine, doesn't it? So that could start to explain why people are interested in it. Because people in power, you know, if they could know to a certainty what's going to happen next week or next year, then you can start to see it's like the old selling your soul to the devil argument, right? Why would someone do something so careless? But in this case, they're basically getting a time machine in the offing.
Right. And that's a good point. I mean, that's exactly why these people in positions of power are pursuing these avenues, because this is what they've always run on, is information control. Okay, if they know the information and you don't, and they can control the information and you can't, then they have control over you. And that's what it's all about in the end of it all.
Well, not only that, think of something like life insurance. You know, 20, 30 years ago, when they were issuing life insurance, they were doing high-end calculations to figure out the probability of how long people will live if they take in this money, how much money gets paid out, all these things. Now, when you bring AI into it, you know, if you were in power and you were worried about a certain group and you had enough data on them, you could simply, you know, run algorithms to find out what's the predictive time when they will die. I mean, do we have to deal with this person? No, I don't think we do. The AI says he's going to die next year. So that problem's taken care of. So that's kind of an example of the power that it gives you to be able to look even just a short distance in the future. Although some of the claims are that it may be able to predict events much further down the road, provided no big event happens in the interim.
Right. And with the infinite data sets they're working with, I mean, this is getting to be a really big thing. We're definitely living in the age of big data. So if they could remove, like, say, their own personal risk from the equation by knowing the outcomes, then of course they're going to do that. I mean, that's what it's all about when it comes down to it. It's control.
Well, even something as, you know, people may be rolling their eyes, but you could use the example of wisdom of the crowd. So say, I don't know, typically wisdom of the crowd is used to guess something. And usually the example you're given is there's all these gumballs in this huge jar. And so the more people that guess at the number of gumballs in the jar using wisdom of the crowd, the closer you get. You typically, once 100 people have guessed, you're usually within about 10% of the true value, which tells you if you get up to 100,000 people to guess, you're going to be pretty much right on the money. But the point I would make is, what if you took something as simple as wisdom of the crowd and you polled 500,000 people, what are the winning lottery numbers for next week? And, you know, averaged them out in the same way. I'm not sure that would work in the same way, but you begin to see that we can actually prove from pretty standard low-level things that this works. Wisdom of the crowd and the law of high numbers both prove that it works. It works so well that Vegas is largely run on the idea of wisdom of the crowd and the law of large numbers. So when you start to get into higher processes, which is what the AI is doing, and you mentioned an infinite data set, well, that's the whole game, isn't it? Because back in the 20s or 30s, when the algorithms were written to deal with data sets of this size, there was no way to deal with it. But now we can truly say the data set is infinite. And the reason we can is because today, so much data will be collected, probably nobody can quantify how much it is. And guess what? There's more on the way already for tomorrow. So I think at this point we can honestly call the data set infinite. And that starts to bring up questions whether an AI device can start to already fathom what the data not yet collected will be. So right. It's paradox after paradox.
Right. And that's where the quantum computer comes in, because this uses a method of an algorithm called combinatorial optimization. This is the method that it uses to calculate these infinite data sets and comes up with the most probable answer to the problem with this. One in particular, the algorithm they use a lot of times is called Monte Carlo. And that relates directly to this, because all of this stuff, all of this math that we're talking about that run these computers with these predictive powers, this is all game theory. This all ties back to game theory. So I would recommend for anybody, if you could find any books on game theory, read them, understand them. This is what the future's about. They're stacking the deck for themselves against us, and they're doing it with game theory.
Right. And this was known for a long time. And as I pointed out in some past episodes, the benchmark to begin to prove your AI was worthwhile was with games. The first benchmark was checkers. The second benchmark was chess. And when they had beat chess and they had a guy on Jeopardy that was also beat by AI, at that point, they wanted to go for the Chinese game Go, which has astronomical possible moves from the outset. The mindset of your opponent plays into it. There's a lot going on in the game Go. That's when they took human intervention into the teaching of the AI out of the teaching of the AI and let the AI teach itself. At that point, within a very short period of time, they beat a grandmaster at Go, which goes to show you that in fact, game theory, basically the reality of our lives, is going to start to be dictated by the idea of what happens in game theory. But anyone who looks it up can see how long game theory has been around. It's crazy to talk about, and normally I would avoid topics like this, except it's verifiable what we're talking about.
Absolutely it is. And like I said, the reason we're talking about this is because it has everything to do with the new book I wrote. This all ties back to transhumanism, and the autism epidemic is no exception to that. And this is what they use. They're using these kind of game theory mathematical models and algorithms to cause these issues in people and kind of hijack their system using these causal circuits that I spoke about earlier. This is what they're doing. They're creating this causal circuit to control the system. And they do this with everything. I mean, this isn't just biology. They could do this with biology, and that's absolutely what's going on with autism and other things. They could do it with everything. They create this causal circuit in something using these cybernetics approaches. And in doing that, they create a feedback loop, and they control the feedback loop so that they could control the outcomes. And that's exactly what they're doing. And it's all based on game theory math.
Well, with enough data, that this is where the kind of scary aspect, the dim future kind of allegorized in the Matrix comes in. where when AI has been learning quickly for a long enough period of time, theoretically, every hour AI exists, it gets that much smarter, right? Once it solves a problem, this was exemplified with the blockchain idea, it never needs to solve that problem again. But you can imagine a time, if all these things are correct, when every human being in the planet falls into some group of human beings. Maybe there's 20 different kinds of top-level human beings. And depending on the group you're in, tells how long you'll be around, maybe if you'll achieve anything important in your lifetime, these types of ideas. And that echoes back to the poke in the eye we got from the Winter Soldier of Marvel, when they basically told everyone the 21st century is an open book for reading. And by the way, we're going to kill a few million people, not because they're a problem now, but they're either a problem now or they will be in 20 years. So we're just going to take care of them all now. And that's the aspect of this that really starts to be kind of shady.
I agree with you 100%. And, you know, as we've discussed in past episodes and stuff, this is absolutely the case. They use these movies to kind of put it out there in the ether so people know what's going on, but really are still clueless about it. But they put it in the entertainment as a tell for people, because it's kind of the karma principle coming into play. So that's what they do. And a lot of these movies are very telling. So the Winter Soldier one, that one's perfect. It really puts a perspective on what they're capable of with this AI right now.
Well, you know, even the main character there, the Winter Soldier, is some subset of a normal human being, right? He's almost autistic as a super soldier in his ability. He can't think for himself. He's controlled by others. Yeah, there's all kinds of allegories going on there. And of course, they throw the winter idea there, you know, coming through the fall, the low point of the sun. It's always in the mix. But are there other aspects that you've covered in your second book that you want to branch off into?
Yeah, we could definitely look at some other things. And I think this is a perfect segue into what we could look at. I think this is a perfect opportunity to segue into another aspect of this autism epidemic that I wrote about. And that's actually the campaign to normalize autism and make it socially acceptable. We see a lot of this going on in the entertainment. For example, I mean, if you look at some of the popular entertainment, one show you guys always talk about, Star Trek, the original Star Trek. The character in that kind of represented the autistic model would be Mr. Spock.
Right. No emotion, very analytical, very, very high-minded in the analytical abilities. And another one I could mention is a show that just ended. The Sheldon character of Big Bang is almost wholly describable as savant or autistic, lacking any emotional interactive abilities of people. But before you go forward with this, I'll just state, we had kind of a weird spring here with all the things that ended. And I haven't had time to look at it, but Big Bang, long running thing ended, Game of Thrones ended, there was the Deadwood thing ended, and the Marvel movies, all big, all far reaching across society, all of them came to an end this spring. But anyhow, go ahead.
How about Westworld?
Did that end? I don't even know that much about it.
I think it's done, but it was more like what it was about and all that. Wayne, are you familiar with Westworld at all?
I haven't watched Westworld. I haven't watched Game of Thrones either, but I was told by other people that the twist in the ending, the character that wound up being king in the end of it all, was a representative of autism when it comes down to it.
Right. And AI as well, because the character who ends up sitting on the throne can see all events that have happened and all events that will happen. So there's a bit of an autistic AI twist there.
Right. And we're not making this up. I mean, this is all across entertainment. Like, that's just three things right now that we just named off that kind of represent this whole thing. You know, Mr. Spock, Sheldon Cooper, what was his name? Bran the Broken or something like that. The guy from Game of Thrones that wound up being king.
Something like that.
Something like that. Yeah. I never watched that show, so I'm not familiar with it. But I've been told from other people that, you know, that's the case. So here's another good example. The movie Ready Player One, the guy who built the Oasis. What was his name? Halliday, was it?
I think so.
Yeah, because I always remember Halliday. Yep, Halliday. I actually read that book because I knew what it was going to be. But go ahead. Yeah, Halliday.
He's the perfect representation of what they want people to accept as being your stereotypical autism. This genius who's socially awkward, and he built this Oasis. He built this virtual reality paradise for people. And he was so smart, he put all these Easter eggs in there for the people to find. And he just represented the autism stereotype in the movie. So that's another one.
Yeah, good point. He kind of is stereotypical there. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's a lot of what they put in these type of movies. So, I mean, that's the whole thing. And they also like to do the transhumanism link and everything. If you look at, the Avengers Endgame, that one, that is so encoded with things. It's unbelievable. It's basically all about transhumanism when it comes down to it. The transhumanist Iron Man saves the world from destruction. That's basically the whole plot of the movie.
Oh, and was in charge of the Avengers.
Right.
Yeah, I haven't seen all that, so I'll have to take your word for it. Wayne, we're getting close to the top of the hour here. We have to come in under an hour so we can run on some of the radio stations that rebroadcast our first hour content. Do you want to sum up anything about the book and then again repeat where people can find the book? And I'll state for the record, Jason and Wayne knew each other since childhood, but reconnected relatively recently. When Jason introduced me, he did so by sending me Wayne's first book on PDF, and I was immediately sold by the time I got to the Overton window idea, because not many people were aware of it, and it's so critically important to what we see going on. But anyhow, Wayne, just give a quick ditty about what your second book's about again and where people can find it. And we'll also state that we'll be able to open up a bit more in hour two to talk about things that that we probably can't get away with in hour one anymore.
Okay. My book's called The Autism Epidemic, Transhumanism's Dirty Little Secret. It's available now on Amazon, and it should be available anytime now from the other fine book retailers. Basically, it covers a lot of different aspects of the autism epidemic. It connects a lot of dots that people would be totally unaware of as to the origins of autism and all the social engineering things that seem to go right along with it. So people, by and large, don't look at autism and see it connected in any way to a lot of these things, especially the transhuman aspect. But I can tell you from the work I've done, there's a there. So if people would like to check it out, I'd appreciate it. If anybody wants to get in touch with me, I could be reached at alchemicaltechrevolution@gmail.com, or they could check out my Facebook page, Files from the Conspiratorium.
Well, here's the thing, man, as we get ready to wrap up here, when we reach a point where things like autism and Alzheimer's are at epidemic levels, and for a long time now, they've been saying, hey, man, we know certainly that in the brains of all these Alzheimer's patients, there's aluminum. And you got to ask, well, if you know this, then why aren't people looking for the cause of the aluminum in the brains? Is it the cooking pans? Is it vaccines? Is it, you know, any number of things where people can start to get aluminum into their bodies? But then again, we see the whole same exact thing with the opioid epidemic. We see all these town halls and all this news, so-called news, saying, hey, man, there's this big opioid epidemic. What can we do? Well, when I was growing up, typically when there was a drug problem, they went after the dealer because that is the source of the problem. And yet we all know who the dealer is here. We all know who's making the opioids, but it's not part of the conversation. And when you start to look at the broad spectrum of the two things I've just outlined, I don't think it's a mystery what's going on. Because if I was in charge and I wanted to know what's causing Alzheimer's, I would instantly begin looking for the aluminum. How is the aluminum getting into human beings? If I was truly concerned about opium addiction, I would say, well, who's dealing this? And we already know who's dealing this. But anyhow, we're going to get into a lot of things in hour two. That does bring hour one of 163 to a close. And we hope to see you all Sunday nights over at Truth Frequency Radio for Crow 777 Live, which is 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Anything you want to add before I close it up, Jason?
How about our Teespring shop?
We put up a Teespring shop to put our web address on bumper stickers and shirts and things like that, because we are no longer getting good search returns or basically any referrals from social media anymore. At this point, we're kind of on our own. So the Teespring shop is a way to get our address out into the world. And by the way, Shoot the Moon is on Vimeo on demand. And if you just search Vimeo for Shoot the Moon or Jason Lindgren or Crow 777, the search return will come up. And we've basically cut the price in half for rentals now. We tried to recoup some of the cost, but there's all that. And we hope you join us for hour two of 163. Cheers.